Red rum, political bedlam. Don't let the hype into your eyes and eardrum. Murdoch on Fox, not 18 with Barackas. And he hate Barack cause he marched with the marches.
I pledge allegiance to the fair and balanced truth. Not the biased truth, not the liar's truth, but the highest truth. I will not be deceived, nor will I believe in the propaganda. I will not.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Francis Wheen, who's a journalist, broadcaster, and writer. He's the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, and he's written for a variety of publications and regularly appears on such BBC programs as The News Quiz. His books include the award-winning biography Karl Marx, A Life, Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francis Wheen.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And Rupert Murdoch, alias the Dirty Digger, is back in the news. I thought that he had dodged a bullet over the scandals, the multitude of scandals involving his newspapers in London. But apparently six journalists, former journalists from the News of the World, were just arrested.
Yes, they were. I mean, this has been going on for some time. It's hardly a week goes by without more Murdoch journalists or former Murdoch journalists being arrested. And actually, to start with, it was all quite entertaining because, you know, everyone hates journalists and most people hate Rupert Murdoch, and so a combination of the two, from the public's point of view, was irresistible. You know, the schadenfreude, the pleasure in seeing these people come a cropper, as we say over here. At that magical moment when Rupert Murdoch flew over to London to be interviewed by a House of Commons committee along with his idiot son, James Murdoch. And James was sort of playing the part of Bart Simpson. And Rupert, for once, was pretending not to be Mr. Burns from The Simpsons and sort of being more like Homer, saying, "Oh, this is the most humble moment of my life." Which Bart, in the film, of course, then says, "No, the most humble moment of your life so far." And that was all very enjoyable. But it's actually, most journalists I know are now beginning to feel the joke is wearing off, because although it's a pleasure to see Murdoch struggling, it's turning quite sinister for journalism over here, certainly, because newspapers are in a mess anyway at the moment. I mean, all over the world they're in a mess, trying to work out how they can stay in business when people are going online and advertising is collapsing and all the old models of publishing a newspaper are no longer valid. At a time like this, the last thing you need is something that makes journalism even harder. And that's what's happening, certainly over here in Britain, because we had an inquiry set up under a judge called Lord Justice Leveson, which sat for about 2 years. And the government set this up as a way of getting itself off the hook. And it was meant to look into not just journalists and their misdeeds, but the police and politicians and their misdeeds, and the whole relationship between police and the press and politicians and the press, the way in which Murdoch had effectively bribed and cajoled and seduced political leaders over many years, and intimidated them as well, basically saying, we'll support you as long as you do what we say and let us have whatever we want in the way of creating media monopolies and bypassing normal laws. And unfortunately, when this report came out, it was scathing about the press, but it let the politicians and the police off the hook. And the police and the politicians, trying to capitalize on this and show that they're the good guys, are now really going for the press. I mean, the politicians are determined to have state-regulated newspapers. Only last week the House of Lords passed a bill, which would mean that any newspaper which does not sign up to a state-appointed regulatory system could be given exemplary damages and made to pay enormous costs and generally, punished and pummeled for not allowing itself, and even to the extent of having to pre-submit articles to this state regulator. So they say you have to, any vaguely contentious article would have to be sent in for pre-clearance, as I think they call it, to this state regulator before you publish it. I mean, this, you know, takes us back hundreds of years. We thought some of these struggles for the free press, you know, from John Wilkes onwards, had been fought and won, but now we're heading backwards because the politicians want to show that they're cracking down, and the police are just the same. I mean, they go around arresting Murdoch journalists in the most dramatic, eye-catching, camera-catching fashion. I mean, they knock on the doors of these people at 6 in the morning and get them out of their beds and come storming in and drag them off. It's a bit like, you know, that phenomenon of the perp walk, the pleasure that the police take in making someone do the perp walk in full view of the cameras. And it's like that. It's purely a media stunt, a publicity stunt. There's no, they could just as well turn up at 10 o'clock in the morning rather than 6 or 5 in the morning. And they, you know, they don't have to go about it so mob-handed. It's not as if these are dangerous killers or armed robbers. These are just sort of hopeless old Murdoch hacks who aren't going anywhere. But they're doing it to salve their consciences, the police, and the politicians are. And actually, some of us in the press, even though we deplore what the Murdoch papers were doing, are beginning to feel that the persecution is getting out of hand, and that, I mean, some of these people who are arrested may or, you know, they may or may not have committed offences. Nobody knows yet because they haven't yet come to trial, but and many of them, I suspect, won't. But there is a slight feeling that it's just become arresting journalists for the sake of it, almost.
It would seem, though, that the possibility of a whole new slew of these high-profile phone hacking victims suing News Corp, which is, I think, months away from floating a separate new company, can't be welcome. I understand your point about the police being perhaps overzealous to overcompensate for the fact that it looked like half of Scotland Yard was on Murdoch's payroll. But tell me about how much this is likely to cost and how much it's going to go on for Murdoch. My understanding is that this whole thing could continue until 2019.
Oh, it will continue for a long time because, I mean, there will be trials. I mean, some people have already been charged and are awaiting trial, not least a woman called Rebecca Brooks, who was the chief executive of Murdoch's company over here, News International, his newspaper company. She and her husband, indeed, are awaiting trial, as is a man called Andy Coulson, who was editor of the News of the World, the famous paper that was closed down, and later went on to be communications director for the Prime Minister, David Cameron, at 10 Downing Street. So, you know, these are just the beginnings. I mean, they've arrested so many people. They've charged a few, but I think they will charge a few more. And these trials are going to go on for, you know, they'll be rattling through the courts for a good few, you know, another 4 or 5 years, I should think. And on top of that, there are all these compensation cases that you mentioned, because some of them have settled. But every time you think it's calming down, or every time Rupert thinks it's calming down, then new evidence comes to light, more people are arrested. I mean, the six people who were arrested yesterday, the six journalists, are arrested in connection with a completely different set of allegations about phone hacking. I mean, it's all a bit, it's one for the, you know, for the connoisseurs and the geeks, this one, but they are actually different from the previous arrests, because all the previous ones were based on records kept by a private detective who worked for the News of the World, private investigator, and they were all from, basically from the newsroom, whereas these people are all from the features department of the News of the World, and they're not from the records of the private detective. So the police have opened up a whole new line of inquiry. So we can expect more arrests, I suspect, over the next few weeks, and more claims for compensation, because even people who've settled, like the actor Hugh Grant and Jude Law and Sienna Miller and all these other various actors and actresses, they may well now start new claims for compensation over these separate allegations of phone hacking. You know, they may then discover that other people at the News of the World in different in the features department were hacking their phones, and they can start the whole process all over again and demand even more compensation. And it's a, I mean, it's a nightmare for Murdoch. It's, I mean, no one knows what the ultimate bill will be, least of all him. But I mean, it's, we're talking hundreds of millions of pounds, of British pounds sterling, hundreds of millions of dollars. Certainly, I mean, I think over 200 million, quite possibly.
Well, apparently 144 out of the 169 civil suits filed against the News of the World have been settled. And you mentioned Hugh Grant, of course, the scandal-prone Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, Uri Geller, God knows what they wanted to know about him, Richard Reardon.
The secret of his spoons, I think.
And this priest who ministered to the singer, Charlotte Church. Apparently the biggest settlement so far is $1.2 million, which was paid out to Gordon Taylor, the head of Britain's Soccer Players Union.
That's right, yes. Well, he got in early, and he got it, and they paid him so much because at that stage they thought they could contain the scandal. And so when he sued, when he discovered that his phone had been hacked, and he sued them, they thought, if we pay him a seven-figure sum, you know, a sum he can't refuse, and as part of the deal, say that he's not allowed to speak about it, then we could still keep the lid on it, and it may, you know, it may go no further than that. That was what they were hoping at the time. That's why they paid him so much. And that nearly worked, except that in 2009, The Guardian then exposed the fact that they had paid him £1 million, and everything came flooding out, and suddenly there were dozens and dozens of other people reaching for their lawyers and bringing in lawsuits.
It's pretty amazing, though, don't you think, Francis Wien, how Murdoch has insulated himself, his vast holdings over here in the United States, and his influence in the media here. I don't know whether you followed the story of General Petraeus, but Bob Woodward, of famous from the Watergate story, All the President's Men, he broke the story, provided an audio tape, which was buried in the style section of the Washington Post. But nevertheless, it was one of the most extraordinary tapes where an emissary from Roger Ailes, who runs Fox News, basically offering the presidency on a plate to General Petraeus, with Roger Ailes taking a leave of absence from Fox News to run a Petraeus campaign, of course, against Obama in the last election, and Rupert would pay for it, and it was a done deal, and all he had to do was sign on the dotted line. And of course, in order to get General Petraeus off the street, Obama, who obviously knew about this offer from Fox, gave him the job at the CIA, which the CIA resented because they didn't like this imperious general, and they then plotted behind the scenes to bring him down. Obviously, he made it easy for them with his ridiculous affair with the biographer. So there is another tale.
Well, I know. I mean, that was an astonishing tale. And as you say, one of the many astonishing things about it was the Washington Post saw fit to put it in the style section. I mean, Carl Bernstein actually wrote a very good piece about it at the time, which was published over here in The Guardian. I don't know if it appeared anywhere in the States, but I assume it did somewhere, saying, you know, why was this not on the front page? This is, you know, front page news. It's not a style story. But a media mogul is actually basically trying to buy the presidency. I mean, you know, Rupert Murdoch, his whole career in Australia, in America, in Britain, has been full of cases of him palling up with chumming up with particular political leaders and doing a deal with them, an implicit deal, saying, right, my papers will back you. I mean, he did it with Gough Whitlam in Australia, but then as often as not, he drops them. And he'll, you know, if he thinks they're turning into losers, he will switch his allegiance absolutely ruthlessly and support somebody else and turn all his papers against his previous friend and support his new friend, and in return expect a lot of favours back. But the Roger Ailes proposal seemed to me to be a new level of Murdoch. You know, instead of trying to seduce an existing political leader, he was trying to create his own president, you know, sort of buy Petraeus before he'd even thought of being a candidate, and say, look, we will run your campaign, finance your campaign, support you. You know, we've got a ready-made presidential campaign for you. You just sign on the dotted line and we'll do the rest. It was extraordinary. And that, I do wonder what's going on at the Washington Post if they don't think that's worth a news story.
But still, the question is hanging. Why is it that in Britain they've gone after Murdoch for his manifest crimes, yet in the United States, the idea that he was trying to fix the presidency and literally by somebody who would actually be likely to be elected. I mean, the American people are probably sufficiently ill-educated to think that this war hero, whose resume is largely bogus, would be a savior for the United States. That
sort of echoes of the Manchurian Candidate, really, isn't it? I mean, it is such a weird story. And all those other films, not just the Manchurian Candidate, but, you know, The Candidate, with Robert Redford, otherwise known as Bob Woodward, and all sorts of, I mean, sort of recurring themes through American films, the idea of, you know, a political candidate who then, you know, it falls prey to sponsors and Svengalis and various other secretive forces that are up to no good. The parallax view, I mean, an inverse version of it, where, you know, you get bumped off by a corporation if you don't do as they tell you. And Murdoch seems, I think, all those years running 20th Century Fox, he can no longer distinguish between some old movie he's seen, some conspiratorial paranoid thriller, and real life. And he's tried to turn real life into one of those films.
But he's had a very toxic effect over here, not just in terms of politics and making politics over here more poisonous and partisan, which is clearly the case, it's to the point where Washington is gridlocked. But he's also probably single-handedly been more responsible for global warming denial. And here you have his home country of Australia literally baking with bushfires and floods, and yet somehow he doesn't make the connection, or if he does, he doesn't care.
Well, oddly enough, there was a brief period where he pretended to care, because his son James, when James Murdoch was the heir apparent, James got into, you know, the environment and became green and made a big push at this and said, we're going to be the greenest corporation in the world. And so his, you know, his indulgent father had to humour him and say, oh yes, James, that's right, we'll be very green, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so even, you know, raucous right-wing tabloid newspapers like The Sun in London were suddenly running these earnest tree-hugging editorials and things, and going on and on about how we must all reduce our carbon footprint. And but of course, one of the many casualties of the scandals of the last 2 years is James Murdoch. You know, that was the end of his really of his status as the favourite son and the man who would inherit everything. And the moment James was made a bit of a fall guy for it, of course Rupert could then stop pretending and go back to his natural self, which was, what's all this global warming rubbish? No, we don't want that. As you say, he's now back to being a climate change denier, and which I'm sure he was all along, but he suspended it for about 2 or 3 years.
Well, just in closing,
in Australia, in his native Australia, I mean, of all the places. But the weird thing is Australia, which, as you say, I mean, it's sort of, the country is burning, it has a very, very vociferous and noisy climate change denial movement. And indeed, Tony Abbott, the leader of the opposition in Australia, you know, who may or may not become prime minister before this year is out, is himself that way inclined.
Well, and so, by the way, is the Republican front runner to run in the next presidency, Marco Rubio, who
I saw him doing his reply to the State of the Union last night, and I thought, good grief, this man could be the Republican candidate in 4 years' time.
Yes, that the government doesn't control the climate.
Rupert, I mean, Rupert is quite old. I mean, there must come a moment where even Rupert Murdoch has to ease off a bit. I mean, no sign of it yet. I mean, his tweets are hilarious. He so loves Twitter. Now he's discovered it. I mean, he's always been a late adopter, Rupert. I mean, when the internet came along, he couldn't understand it, and so he thought it wasn't important. And so his papers were very late in going online. And then, of course, because he left it so late, he panicked and bought up MySpace for far too much money and lost an absolute fortune on it. So he's always been a bit clumsy about that sort of thing. But he's now found Twitter. And it's added a whole new dimension of terror to being a Murdoch editor, because they have to look at his tweets all the time to find out whether they're going to be sacked or whether he's publicly denouncing them. I mean, only this week, over here in The Sun, this tabloid paper of his, ever since he bought it in 1969. He's had page three girls, which every day on page three of this paper, they have a topless woman, a large photo of a topless woman showing her breasts. It's been going on for decades, and he's always supported it. I remember once being thrown out of his flat. His previous wife, Anna Murdoch, I went round to talk to some years ago, and I'd heard that she was embarrassed, you know, at dinner parties and things, if people mentioned that her husband owned this paper with all these topless women in it, and that she didn't like it. And so I put it to her and said, "Are you not embarrassed by this?" And she got very angry. She said, "My husband is a great man. How dare you suggest that I could be embarrassed by anything he does? Get out of my..." She summoned the butler to throw me out. But on Twitter the other day, someone, just some ordinary woman in Britain, tweeted him and said, "You know, topless women, page three girls, are so 20th century. We're so over them." And he suddenly tweeted back, "Yeah, you may be right, actually. I think we may have to stop them." And this is the first the editor of The Sun had heard about it. And again, they had a cartoon in the Sunday Times in London. And the editor of the Sunday Times was defending it against people who said it was anti-Semitic. It showed Netanyahu building a wall with blood of Palestinians or something, and by a Gerald Scarfe cartoon. And the editor was defending it, and then someone said to him, "I think you better look at Twitter. Rupert Murdoch has just apologised for it without telling you."
Okay. Just in closing, Francis Wayne, is there any news on the succession? You know, eventually he will meet his maker, Rupert, and I'm assuming it'll be the one below, rather, as opposed to the one up in the pearly gates.
I don't think he'll meet his maker. I think he'll go for it. It's like, it reminds... Actually, he does remind me a bit of... about 10 years ago, when I was in Cuba, in Havana, and Fidel Castro was there at an event, and I was talking to one of the people by him, and even then he was quite old, and I said, "Well, presumably when Fidel Castro goes, when he dies, you know," and he said, no, we don't say that over here. We say if." And it's a bit like that with Murdoch. No one dares say to him, "Well, actually, you're mortal, Rupert. You're not going to go on forever," because no one's told him. He's unstoppable. He's full of plans, full of ideas, and having a great time. But he's the succession is a terrific mess because, well, you know, he so wants to hand it over to a child of his, and his shareholders so don't want that. I mean, the shareholders are utterly fed up with this dynastic approach, you know, the Kim Il-sung handing over to Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un. It's just like that. It's sort of, you know, Keith, his father, Sir Keith Murdoch, handed over his rather tiny press empire to Rupert, and then Rupert creates an enormous empire and wants to hand it over to somebody. And first of all, there was Lachlan, and then he lost interest, and so James was promoted, and Elizabeth Murdoch then wandered off to do her own thing. She's now very much back, actually. She's now probably in a better position than either of those boys. But, of course, there's the new generation, the young school-age children now. So if Rupert lives long enough, maybe the new children with his latest Chinese wife will be old enough for him to anoint them as heirs. But I don't think... there comes a point where... the shareholders, although they respect Rupert and they don't like to challenge him directly, you know, they're not going to tolerate him just imposing some unqualified child of his as the supreme commander of the great Murdoch empire all over the world if it's going to affect the share price and going to affect their investment. I mean, sooner or later, they're going to have to take him aside and say, "Look, Rupert, we're very grateful you've created a wonderful thing. We've all made lots of nice money out of it. But, we don't want someone called Murdoch running this ever again."
Well, Francis Wayne, I thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all.
Again, I've been speaking with Francis Wayne, who is a journalist, broadcaster and writer. He's the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, and he's written for a variety of publications and regularly appears on such BBC programs as The News Quiz. His books include the award-winning biography Karl Marx, A Life, Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about nationwide demonstrations this Sunday against the Keystone XL pipeline.